Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome to the Cato Institute. My name is Marianne Tupi. I'm the founder and editor of humanprogress.org, and I'm also a senior fellow here at Cato. Before we start, please be so kind and make sure that your phones are switched off, which is, of course, not something I've done. Correct it. It is with great pleasure that I welcome back to the Cato Institute two of my favorite people, Claire Routledge, we will talk about in a moment, but of course the star of the afternoon is Alex Hammond. Alex was an intern at Cato, that's how he started, later becoming a research assistant, during which time he started publishing, not just helping with human progress, which is of course what was invaluable, but also started publishing a series of articles online called The Heroes of Progress. Finally, this year, we were able to turn that series of articles into this lovely volume, Heroes of Progress, 65 People Who Changed the World. And I believe that the publication day is today. So
2 days ago.
2 days ago. Excellent. So as of 2 days ago, you can pick up a copy of Heroes of Progress in all the best bookstores around the world, including, of course, Amazon. So, Alex, of course, aside from his affiliation with Cato, is the founder of the Initiative for African Trade and Prosperity, a free trade fellow at the Institute of Economic Affairs in London, and a senior fellow at African Liberty, as well as a fellow at Epicenter. He was formerly, as I said, at the Cato Institute as well as IEA. Alexander's popular publications have been translated into more than a dozen languages and appeared in major newspapers across Europe, North America, and Africa. Alex currently resides in Switzerland and works for the Rising Tide Foundation, where he oversees a portfolio of grants and projects that promote the rule of law, free markets, moral agency, and limited government worldwide. So we will start with Alex, maybe 15 to 20 minutes, talking about your beautiful new book.
Well,
welcome.
Thank you. So thank you very much, Marian. It's marvelous to be back. It's actually 8 years ago this week that I received the email confirming that my application to the Cato Institute was successful. And I spent countless hours, two formative years here and countless hours in this auditorium. So it's really great to be back. And I indeed actually met my wife at one of these lunch events, and afterwards we ended up sitting at the same table. It was actually one of your lunches, your events. So yes, I owe a lot to this organization. So
I have a lot to claim credit for.
You do. So thank you to the marketing team, the events team, the Human Progress team, Ian, Eleanor, Ivan, to Clay for traveling all the way to DC to share his immense insights and knowledge with us. To Marian for his years of mentorship, and to you guys all in the audience for coming out to learn more about the book. So for 11 years, humanprogress.org has shared thousands of different data points about how the world is getting better. Stats like how in the last 200 years, extreme poverty has declined by 90%, how illiteracy has declined by 86% in the same time period, how life expectancies have doubled in the last two centuries too. And yet, despite this news being out there in the world, there is still a huge amount of pessimism and skepticism about humanity's ability to overcome the problems of the day. Consider this, according to a 2020 YouGov poll, when my fellow Brits were asked, generally speaking, do you think the world is becoming a better or worse place, or is it staying much the same? Of my fellow Brits, 70% thought the world was getting worse, and just 4% thought it was getting better. And you can't blame this sentiment on charming British pessimism, because in 2016, when Americans asked almost exactly the same question, 65% of you thought the world was getting worse, and 6% thought it was getting better. And finally, there's a more recent survey in 2022, and it showed that one-third of Americans and half of all Americans under 30 reported feeling anxious all or most of the time. Now, what inspired me to write this book is the suspicion that these two studies and findings were quite linked. I believe that part of the skepticism about the state of the world today is in large part because of our, frankly, ignorance of the progress that has come before, and especially around the people who have driven this progress. There are dozens of people who have come before and still actually live, some who still live today, who have saved millions, if not billions, of lives. Their shoulders are ones that the modern world really rests on, and yet most of us could only name a couple of them, let alone their stories. And you could blame this on the kind of post-1960s intellectual climate that kind of deemed it uncool to champion people who came before, or the media establishment that kind of by its nature broadcasts very bad news about the state of the world. It gets far more clicks. But it's clear we've stopped valorizing people who have come before. And therefore, if we can't look at those who came before, it's also very difficult to analyze the societal and economic conditions that made their innovations possible. So what is a hero of progress? I've defined a hero of progress to be someone who has saved or significantly improved the lives of millions of people. It could be agronomists such as Norman Borlaug, whose hybrid wheat saved upwards of a billion lives in the 1960s. Intellectuals like Richard Cobden, who changed public policy and removed barriers to human flourishing. Or business people like the American Malcolm McLean, who created containerization, literally shipping containers, and that fundamentally revolutionized global trade and raised living standards for billions of people across the world. Or scientists like Edward Jenner or Jon Snow, who ended pandemics and eliminated diseases. And I think it's quite important when we're looking at the heroes of progress is to consider that just because someone is listed as a hero, it does not mean that I, or I assume heroes of progress, or Cato, or likely Clay too, endorse all aspects of their lives. Some of the heroes held very repugnant views. They did egregious acts separate from their world-changing innovation. All were just generally unpleasant. And quite a good example of this is Fritz Haber and Karl Bosch. These are the two Germans, one scientist and one engineer, who successfully created the Haber-Bosch process, which converts nitrogen from the air into ammonia, which can be then used as fertilizer to increase crop yields. Now, this creating synthetic fertilizer revolutionized global agriculture. It prevented a global famine, likely saved upwards of a billion people. Huge impact on the world. And yet, Fritz Haber, during World War I, he developed chlorine gas and worked as chief for the German chemical warfare service. In World War II, Karl Bosch, actually a bit before World War II, but Karl Bosch worked for his company, hugely benefited from Nazi government contracts, and he was also created the nitric acid used to make saltpeter explosives. So, of course, I'm not endorsing all aspects of our life, but I think it's quite important to realize that these heroes, like all people, are not perfect in every way. And if we look at the 65 people in this book, and I know it's a fairly small sample size, but to be honest, there's not too many people who have saved or improved millions of lives. But if we look at them, we do discover quite a few interesting things. And it's probably unsurprising for an audience of the Cato Institute to hear that there's an extraordinary link between the frequency of these world-changing innovators and the degree of freedom across the world. Consider this. In the 14th, 15th, 16th, and 17th century, only one hero in the book was born in each of those centuries. Nine were born in the 18th century, 24 were born in the 19th century, and 28 were born in the 20th century. And of course, it's a limited sample size, but I believe as the world became freer, the number of innovators significantly rose. Because of course, it's only when people have the agency and freedom to pursue their ideas and turn their ideas into innovations that the world can prosper and take advantage of that. And to create these ideas, people need to be free to speak, publish, associate, disagree, take risks, and perhaps most importantly, disrupt the status quo. And then there also needs to be a range of pro-market policies that allow them to test these ideas in an undisrupted, uncorrupted price mechanism too. And what I've found, and I didn't intentionally do this to any degree, but As the book is laid chronologically, as it goes on, the diversity of the heroes significantly increases as the degree of freedom across the world does. It starts out quite very much focused on innovators from the Netherlands, the UK, some parts of Western Europe, then it spreads to America, and then as freedom spreads, so too do where the innovators come from. So freedom is important. However, readers with a keen eye who read this book will actually notice there are a few heroes not from societies that were free at the time. And in the limited instances of this, in every case, the heroes did one or two things. They either immigrated, sometimes quite a lot, to gain the networks, the mentorship, the education, the freedoms that they simply didn't have in their home country. And Erasmus is quite a good example of this. He was one of the first modern champions of peace and toleration. And during his lifetime in the 16th century, he moved almost relentlessly throughout Europe, from the Netherlands to France to the UK, I think back to France, to Italy, to Belgium, to Switzerland. This is in a time where it was very difficult to move, and yet he continued to do so. And many other heroes did the same. And then the second interesting thing is there are some heroes not from free societies like Yao Longping, his name is, a Chinese agronomist. However, every instance of a hero not from a free society, they actually got special government permission to continue the innovating and to be free to test their ideas. Sir John Harrington, who's the inventor of a flushable toilet, many people did not really like his work. He liked disrupting the status quo. However, he managed to get away with it because he was the godson of the queen at the time. With Yao Longping from China, who created hybrid rice, which saved hundreds of millions of people, and I think about 100 million people still rely on his crop today. He was actually targeted during the Cultural Revolution. He was denounced. People were claiming he was a sympathizer to the opposite side and what have you. And it wasn't until a high-up government official from a state or a region, province far away, wrote a letter to clear his name that he was then able to continue. So that's how, even if you're not from a free society, some of our heroes managed to innovate. They managed to get special government permissions, which, although it's great for them and it's caused some progress, you just imagine the millions of people who hadn't had these permissions, don't have them today, and therefore can't help change the world. So the other side of the coin, freedom is very important to these innovators. However, and I feel weird saying this at the Cato Institute, freedom is, and free societies is only one side of the coin. The other is the individual, the human mind, the ultimate resource, as it was called by the late Maryland University economist and I believe former Cato senior fellow,
correct,
Julian Simon. He dubbed it the ultimate resource. And this is based on the idea that nations, governments, societies, businesses, groups, algorithms, computers, at least yet, not yet, they don't create ideas. Really, they spring forth from a human brain. So we've got humans, human brain, freedom, and within the individual heroes, there is actually a few, even though I'm not the psychologist here, a few kind of psychological traits that really bind them together. And one of those is a real tenaciousness towards their work ethic. Most refused to take no for an answer, worked relentlessly to pursue what they deemed meaningful. And we've got quite a few examples of this throughout the book, but one good one would be Pearl Kendrick and Grace Eldering. These were two scientists in the 1930s in Grand Rapids in a lab. Due to funding limitations and perhaps some discrimination because of their sex and gender, they weren't allowed to spend their work day working on developing a vaccine for the whooping cough. Instead, for years, they devoted their evenings, their weekends, their holidays to pursuing this goal. And eventually, years later, they were successful. And so far, that vaccine for whooping cough has saved over 15 million lives. And yet they weren't allowed to work on it during their day. And I think that also speaks to what you can achieve with your so-called side hustle, in a way. And John Stuart Mill actually portrays that quite well, too. For much of his life, he was a civil servant. and he still wrote relentlessly and probably changed classical liberal framework and ideas as we know them and formed them. When the German scientist Wilhelm Röntgen claimed that he could take pictures of the insides of people's bodies, people thought he was crazy. And yet today, X-rays are a pillar of a medical field and likely something most of us in this room have benefited from at some point in time. Similarly, with Louis Pasteur, when he claimed, it doesn't seem very outrageous now, but when he claimed that life doesn't spontaneously appear from non-living matter via what was then known as spontaneous generation, people thought he had lost his marbles and denounced him widespread. And yet pasteurization and the germ theory of disease has saved hundreds of millions, if not billions, of lives and is really fundamental to what we know about the medical field and science. So despite their quite resounding perseverance and grit, this relentless work ethic might also speak to a broader psychological trait, which I think was quite common in many of the heroes, and they were quite high in this, and that is disagreeableness. I know Marion's written before on the link between disagreeableness and innovation, but I think someone that highlights this quite well is a man called Maurice Hilleman, an American scientist, probably one of the more unsung heroes of progress. And he is credited with saving more lives than any other medical scientist in the 20th century. One of his mentees noted in recent years that on his desk he had a row of shrunken heads representing each employee he had fired from his lab. Those later turned out to be fake, but he kept them there as trophies. He ran his lab like a military unit, said his mentee, and he refused to accept mandated classes by his employer that hoped to make middle managers more civil and nice. And yet, during his lifetime, he developed over 40 vaccinations and created 8 of the 14 recommended in current schedules. Now, Hilleman might be a bit of an extreme example, but I guess what I'm trying to get across here is on a social level, many of the heroes were far from spectacularly charismatic. Some were, like Richard Cobden and William Wilberforce, two fellow Brits, I may add. But many were frankly very good at processing information on a level that doesn't correspond to charming, charismatic, casual conversation. And in my opinion, if many of the heroes were around today, I think it's quite likely most of them would have been, maybe not most, but many of them would have been fired or canceled long before they made their world-changing innovation. So I think that's quite important for the modern free speech movement. Perhaps it is actually undermining global progress. It's certainly undermining innovation if we don't accept eccentrics and disagreeable people. So there is some hope. We know that freedom, innovative human minds, and the skills and the belief that you can make the difference are crucial factors that have united the heroes and has driven global innovation and thus global prosperity. And while the idea of innovation-related stagnation is quite popular at the moment, I think it's quite important to remember there's a huge amount of untapped potential out there. Billions of people do not feel empowered or capable of pursuing their goals, and we also have billions more living in unfree societies who lack fundamental rights, who have difficulty just going about their day, let alone trying to take on innovative new pursuits, create their own companies, test an idea in the marketplace. So, and that's why I consider the work of Cato, of Archbridge, of countless other projects across the world that are trying to push for a freer, more educated, more empowered society to be so important to global innovation and global prosperity. So to wrap up, Heroes of Progress aims to combat the ingratitude that has permeated a lot of our intellectual climate, our media climate, and subsequently our society as a whole. The wealth and health of the modern world rests on the shoulders of a few dozen relatively unknown innovators who have saved millions, if not billions, of lives. And I humbly think, given their contribution to humanity, these stories are ones we should all know just a little bit more about. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alex, very much. We will now hear from Dr. Clay Routledge, He is the Vice President of Research and Director of Human Flourishing Lab at the Archbridge Institute. As a leading expert in existential psychology, Clay's work focuses on helping people reach their full potential and build meaningful lives. He's a highly cited researcher who has published more than 100 scholarly papers, co-edited 3 scholarly handbooks, and authored 3 books. He has also authored numerous articles for outlets such as the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, USA Today, Newsweek, Fortune, Business Insider, Entrepreneur, The Hill, and the Harvard Business Review. His latest book is Past Forward: How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life. With that, Clay, over to you.
Thanks, Manny. Thanks for inviting me here. Kato people, I think this might be my 3rd or 4th time here. First time in this pretty awesome auditorium, I have to say. Nice renovation, but 3rd or 4th time here. Big fan of Marian, big fan of the work at Human Progress. Often when I do my own doom scrolling, I like to then do a nice palate cleanse with going to Human Progress and reminding myself that there is a lot of good things in the world happening. Of course, we're here to celebrate Alex's book, which, congratulations.
Thank you.
It's a great book. I had an opportunity to read an advanced copy and also interview Alex for Perfectus, a magazine that I co-edit. So many of our discussions on progress, at least what I've noted, tend to focus on scientific, technological, economic, public policy factors that improve our world or act as barriers to progress. And I think that's important. Those are the most direct factors that we can think about as influencing progress. But one thing I really, really liked about Alex's book is he put the emphasis on the human part of human progress by reminding us that, yes, all these environmental factors matter, but behind those factors are individual brains. And in those brains are ideas. And these are the ideas that spark innovation, that advance causes like freedom, like progress. And so I really thought that was a nice feature to, you know, the common discussions we often have about the actual innovations. But there's people behind those innovations. So Marian invited me here to talk about more of the cultural side of progress. And I think there is good signs that you're starting to see some voices on the center left and center right that are responding to the more populist and doomer pessimistic perspectives on their respective sides and saying, no, things aren't all horrible. We can't actually come together and solve some problems. The world's not a total dystopia. There are good things going on, and we can make improvements. So I think that's an encouraging sign that we're seeing. But one thing that I'd like to emphasize, as Marian noted, I'm a psychologist, is when we think about the best way to advance cultures of progress, we need to really think more about how culture works, and particularly how it interacts with the human minds, with the individuals. And so, for instance, you'll often see people say, well, there's a lot of negativity out there, right, in our entertainment, in our media, and so we need to have a more positive vibes, right? We need more positive energy out in our culture. I totally agree with that, but how do you actually do that? What's it mean? And so what I thought I'd do is just provide 3 examples of, I think, psychological findings or areas in psychology that wouldn't be intuitive to you if you were thinking, oh, here's a good way to have a more positive, optimistic culture. They would do counterintuitive in some ways. Oh, and by the way, I should say, when you were talking about your surveys about the pessimism in the UK, in the US, at Archbridge, we ran a survey last year, a nationally representative survey of US adults. And we actually asked them, we gave them 2 possibilities. We said, which one of these do you agree with? In the coming decades, humans will make significant progress on big societal challenges, global challenges, and life will be better for future generations. Or in the coming decades, we won't make progress on these challenges and life will be worse for future generations. Unfortunately, and this was run in 2023, only 44% of Americans endorsed the more positive vision, the more hopeful vision of the future. So the majority of Americans do not believe that we will make progress on big challenges. So there's definitely work to do, and I'm glad this book and all the other books that Human Progress has been putting out are out there. So here's my three examples of things that I think that would be useful for cultivating a psychology of progress. So topic number one is mental health. As was already noted, we've all seen this rise in anxiety and depression and related negative cognitions and emotions, particularly among young generations. Now there is some debate that, which we won't litigate here, there is some debate on the extent to which these are real increases in pathology or whether we're somehow, there's a concept creep kind of going on and we're looking at symptoms that are milder than we might think. And now calling them pathological. But putting that aside for a minute, what we can realize is mental health is kind of a distinct phenomenon compared to other problems we might want to address, in that it's mediated by our subjective experience, right? In fact, most of our diagnostic capacities involve actually asking people questions about their current mental health. So there's that subjective experience challenge. So at a minimum, we know that people feel, especially young people, feel more anxious, and they feel more depressed, and they feel more distressed. And so the question is, how do we do that? Now, in a culture of progress, people might say, well, what we need is we need to bring more attention to these mental health problems, or we need more mental health awareness campaigns, for instance, because that's the way we solve other things. If we had an increase in cancer rates, we would try to do more awareness campaigns, right? But again, mental health is kind of distinct, so it seems intuitive might actually be counterproductive. For instance, there's a psychologist at Oxford named Lucy Fulks who's put out this idea called the prevalence inflation hypothesis. And her hypothesis is that by bringing more attention to mental health, which does reduce stigma, does have a number of positive effects, has unintended consequences, which include getting more people to be thinking about their mental health. And the more you think about your mental health, the more you tend to ruminate. And the more you ruminate, you might start to see relatively mild symptoms as more pathological. And so this might actually have the self-fulfilling prophecy of getting people to think, I wonder if yes, I am anxious now that you brought my attention to it. And I wonder if that's a problem. And the challenge for things like anxiety is the more you ruminate about those things, the more you kind of withdraw from the world, you become more avoidant, which actually increases the likelihood that you will have more anxiety. And so a culture of progress might intuitively assume that we should bring more attention to these problems and have more public discussions around mental health. And there are definitely benefits to that. But we should also be aware of the potential risks associated with having a culture in which we're constantly fixated on our own psychological processes. Psychologists have, going way back, have long understood the challenge of being an intelligent organism like humans is our capacity for self-consciousness and how that can make us a very anxious, neurotic species if we dedicate too much of our time turning inward and ruminating about our own thoughts. So a solution might be to spend less time, to advance a culture that spends less time asking people to think about how they currently feel and more time encouraging people to go out in the world and do the educational, entrepreneurial, like all sorts of activities, community, philanthropic, all these activities that build communities. Actually, it turns out those may be some of the best therapeutic ways to improve your own mental well-being. So that's one example. A second example relates to entertainment. Just before we started, Marion and I were talking about the new Dune movie. One thing I think that's interesting in a lot of, at least online conversations about progress and its connection to entertainment is the idea that we have too much dark, dystopian, apocalyptic content out there in like the entertainment, like the movies and the TV shows we watch. It's about a climate apocalypse. It's about killer AI robots. And that might be holding us back in some ways. It might make us overly scared. Well, there might be more more than meets the eye when it comes to that. So behavioral scientist Colton Scrivener, who is a researcher at the Recreational Fear Lab, has argued that actually, like, scary play, scary fiction, scary entertainment, in a lot of ways, helps us. It gives us a safe space to kind of work through our worries about things. We go to haunted houses, for instance, as a way to have, like, a safe environment to have this kind of entertainment experience, but it might actually reduce our anxiety. So, for instance, his research team found that during the pandemic, people who watched a lot of apocalyptic films actually were more emotionally resilient during the pandemic. So, and I interviewed him for Perfectus Magazine, and I just wanted to share this quote because I just thought it was really insightful. He said, I'd ask him about this idea, like, oh, do we have too much dark dystopian fiction, and do we need more positive stuff? And by the way, I totally think we need more positive science fiction entertainment, or just more science fiction in general as a sci-fi fan, I should say. But he said, things aren't always as they seem. It's easy to imagine that the only route to promoting something like human flourishing is to promote positively valenced things. However, we sometimes need to face the negative things to flourish. Take the immune system as an analogy. Our immune system can learn to overcome pathogenic threats to being exposed to safe versions of those threats via inoculations. To someone who doesn't know anything about the immune system or human sickness, that sounds crazy. But as soon as you understand a little bit more about how the immune system works, it makes perfect sense. The same is true for our fears. We can learn how to overcome our fears by being exposed to safe versions through scary play. So as someone who consumes a ton of apocalyptic, dystopian entertainment myself, I was comforted. That's really why I asked him that question. I was comforted to know, no, I'm probably fine. I think I actually had asked him, I'm like, hey, I'm a pretty positive person. I'm optimistic about the future. Why am I constantly watching these things about the future is going to be a hellscape? And so it might be okay. The third and final example I'd like to provide relates to research that I've actually been doing for over two decades now, which is on the psychology of nostalgia. One of my big goals in the kind of progress space has been to convince some of my fellow progress advocates that nostalgia is not bad. Because this is a constant theme I see people writing about. They say, well, nostalgia is bad because it's sort of worthless entertainment, and it's a distraction. At its worst, it's actually making you look towards the past very positively, which makes you feel worse about the present, and maybe holds you back from spending that time constructively building a better future. But turns out that's not really how nostalgia works. Sure, you can point to polls where they say the majority of Americans think life 50 years ago was better than it is today, which I actually don't think is a great question, because I think if you actually asked Americans, well, what aspect of life do you think was better? Would you trade today's medical treatment for the medical treatment that would have been available 50 years ago? All of a sudden, they'd be like, well, maybe not. Would you rather raise your daughter 50 years ago than today with fewer opportunities for women? Well, maybe not. You know what I mean? So if you get more specific, if you get more surgical, their views on nostalgia become more precise as well. But what I think is really going on here is a misunderstanding of the correlation between nostalgia and people's dissatisfaction in the present. What people think is, oh, you look back in the past and that makes you dissatisfied today. You idealize the past and that makes you dissatisfied today. We've done hundreds of well-controlled experimental studies now. It's actually the reverse. People are dissatisfied today, which makes them look back nostalgically. And that nostalgia comforts them, but in addition to that, it kind of takes them out of the moment. And they say, yeah, like today, it seems like there's a lot of polarization. Or today, I'm really upset about this. Or today, I feel lonely or sad. But I haven't always felt this way. Or, like, there's other points in time that have been more optimistic or more fulfilling, or people have been more connected And that gives them the hope and the motivation for positive change. So in our experimental studies, for instance, we find negative psychological states like loneliness, sadness, anxiety trigger nostalgia. And nostalgia actually makes people feel more meaningful. It makes them feel more grateful for the life they have. It makes them more optimistic about the future. It makes them more creative in problem-solving tasks. And it makes them, really pushes them outward. It makes people want to connect with others. You can think about this even in like a lighthearted entertainment sort of way. Think about some kind of pop cultural phenomenon that was nostalgia-driven. People don't just want to consume it for themselves. They want to connect with other fans, right? They want to share their experiences. They want to find ways to be part of a community. And nostalgia tends to do that. So again, I think this is another example of where our intuitions might be, oh, looking backwards positively is probably bad for progress. The actual evidence suggests, no, for most people, most of the time, their reflections on the past that are positive are really about helping them connect the past to the present, to the future, and move through time with a sense of purpose, a sense of motivation and focus. Of course, some politicians manipulate that in the same way that nostalgia is often experienced. Politicians don't start by telling you the past is better. They start by telling you, trying to convince you that the present is bad and that you need to look to the past for a better time. So there's certainly a weaponization and manipulation of nostalgia that can be unhealthy. But for most people, most of the time, what nostalgia really is it's that way of finding that connecting with a youthful spirit, finding that energy, looking to the past for some sort of inspiration or guidance, and then moving forward with hope and optimism. If you don't believe the behavioral science on this, just go talk to entrepreneurs, artists, technologists. Find the people that you think are on the bleeding edge of future-oriented thinking, and just ask them, what inspired them? How did they get into this? And all of them will have their nostalgic memories. They'll remember the time in which somebody, they had a mentor that influenced them. A filmmaker will tell you that time they saw that first movie that was like, oh yeah, this is why I want to do this. A musician that's doing very innovative, new, creative work will tell you about all the past music that inspired them that they're trying to build from. So really, I think in a lot of ways, nostalgia, that's why I call my book Past Forward, is very future-oriented. So these are just three examples where I think intuitively we might say, well, to advance a culture of progress, we should bring a lot more attention. We should have more mental health awareness campaigns because mental health is a problem. We should have more people thinking about their mental health. We should be watching fewer apocalyptic movies. And we should avoid nostalgia at all costs. But my point is, and these are just three examples, that there's more to the story than that. In a lot of cases, the opposite might be true. We might need to spend less time focused on our mental health. We might be perfectly fine with consuming apocalyptic media. I totally agree that we could use some more positive, inspirational stories as well. This is one of the things that's great about the book, is you can learn about heroes of progress. And we shouldn't be afraid of our nostalgia. It's often a great source of inspiration and hope for us. So I'll just close real quickly by returning to Alex's book. One of the things that I think Alex does that actually aligns very well with what we know in psychological science is his focus on, this is going back to the idea of his focus on the humanity of progress. So some of us are kind of weird in that we like data, and we like big data. We like thinking about trends. We like thinking about processes. Sometimes you hear people refer to this as like having a systemizing mind. Some of us are into that stuff, but it turns out most people, what really moves them are the human stories. Like humans are a very social species. We're very biased, even from from birth, our eyes naturally gravitate towards the eyes of other humans. It's just in us to be social. This is why if you want to convince someone to care about a problem like poverty, it's great to have the statistics so they can see the scale of it. But it's also good to have those human stories to be like, this is what it's like to be a person living in that situation, right? And often that is really what moves people. So if we want to advance the cause of human progress, we need all the data, right? We need the evidence. We need to be able to litigate a case that the world has advanced a lot and can continue to. And the conditions for that, including freedom, education, the other issues that were raised. But we also need to connect people to the stories, to the real human stories, even the messy ones, as Alex pointed out. Like, none of us are perfect. But this is what really, for a lot of people, this is what really inspires them to care about topic. And again, I think you did a wonderful job with that, and should turn your book into a television program. So anyway, that's it for me. Thank you so much.
Thank
again
you, Clay,
for
very much. I'm going to start by abusing my chairman's privilege and ask you both a question very quickly. Alex, when it comes to innovators, people who have this sort of unique insight that can help humanity move forward, there seem to be two schools of thought. One is that we can stimulate the growth of innovation, stimulate the growth of innovators by, for example, government spending, contribution much more to, you know, R&D programs, what have you. And since money is no object in Washington, D.C., with our national, with the budget planned at $7.3 trillion, there are a lot of people in the sort of D.C. Biosphere who are arguing, you know, just put more money behind innovation and it will happen. The alternative is that we don't really know where innovation comes from. We just hope that the more people there are in the world, you know, some of them are going to have these insights because they just appear out of nowhere amongst people we often don't expect. And a question for you, Clay. So let me just get the story right on sci-fi. He's arguing, because again, so many people in the techno-optimist world are arguing we just need more optimistic sci-fi movies. But am I right to understand that, yes, we could use more optimistic sci-fi movies, but the production of negative sci-fi movies don't actually cause any serious harm. Is that how I should read that research?
I wouldn't quite phrase it that way.
Okay.
Because they might have multiple effects. I would say what he's arguing is they might do a lot of things, but one of the but they don't necessarily make people more like anxious about. So because one of the arguments you're talking about is like, oh well, people are watching these movies about climate apocalypse and that's making them feel hopeless or making them think the problem is worse than it is. And then how are they going to advance progress now that they've kind of like they're more pessimistic or whatever? I think his argument would be like, actually people do have these kinds of anxieties and it's not they weren't necessarily produced by the science fiction. You can watch the nightly news and get that. What that science fiction might be doing is helping them kind of work through those fears in it. Because when you watch one of these movies, you're not actually living through a zombie apocalypse. It's not real. Or an AI apocalypse or whatever. And just having that experience of like being in that space with that content might actually help you work through this. That might be one of the evolutionary sort of functions of scary play.
Okay.
Through like desensitizing it.
Yeah, so you know, kind of like that. And then also, you know, on some things it might be because when you talk about the techno-optimists, I mean, a lot of them, from my understanding, they'll talk about the Terminator. You know, maybe they're doing really innovative work in AI space and they'll talk about the Terminator, which is a very dark vision of artificial intelligence. But that might have given them some ideas, right? They might be like, oh, well, I don't want that. I don't want Skynet, right? But I want like a more positive. So I think that's part of it too, is just sort of working in that kind of safe space.
Counterintuitive, but that's why we have smart people here to make us think.
But that's not to say that we couldn't use more, because we also know from psychology, you need good models of positive. So I don't know if I don't think we have any knowledge on like the perfect ratio of like how much negative to positive. But one thing I will say, this is not what Colton said in his research, but just from my own personal experience of spending a considerable amount of time watching negative sci-fi content, is even in these stories, there's often resilience, triumph over tragedy, like the human side of the story is often like, even if it's robots are killing civilization, the human side of the story is like kind of celebrating human agency and the capacity to fight back and to, you know, to advance a different vision. So I think there's a lot of complexities too in these stories. It's easy to just say, oh, look how bad all the science fiction is, when a lot of times there is more going on in there. And I think that would be worth considering too before. It's easy just to say, oh, we have too much negative sci-fi. Really, I'm just trying to make excuses for the fact that I like dystopian science fiction.
Alex, over to you.
So this is about the government versus spontaneous innovation. Yeah, I mean, so to be fair, there have been some examples throughout history of, and in the book, of kind of government-led innovation, but it's quite rare. That innovation then is also then would only be solely scientific and technical rather than cultural or perhaps through a policy change. So you did mention having the increased numbers of human brains being important and the implication there that fewer brains, thanks to depopulation, could undermine innovation. And I think that this is a worry, but I think the biggest concern and something we can deal with right now is the billions who aren't in the condition to be able to innovate, whether it's due to their freedom or their lack of education or their lack of belief. Vast proportions of people in Africa and Asia and to some degree South America, simply it's very difficult to set up a business. It's very difficult to be able to send their kids to school. Potentially there's a government monopoly on schools, so therefore you can't send them to a low-cost private school. You have to send them to the state school. So sure, I think depopulation is an issue, but the most pressing one right now is much more about people who are already on this world.
Yeah, very good point. Actually, this morning I was looking at a Lancet study, recent Lancet study from this month about population projections, and they are finding that only 10% of all births are happening within high-income countries which innovate, which means that 90% of births are going on in places that really don't have the opportunity to contribute to the growth of human knowledge. Well, with that, let's open it to Q&A. We'll be talking questions both online, they're coming in, and also in the audience. So please speak clearly and directly into the microphone there over there. So that everybody can hear you, and if you have a question, please ask it as a question. Okay, sorry, yes, right here. Also, if you could give us your name and affiliation. I keep on reading from an endless list of instructions.
Thank you. I'm Leon Weintraub. I'm a retired member of the Foreign Service. I'm wondering if, in looking to select individuals who contribute to progress, what did you look at the historical sweep of what I would call the Western civilization, for example, like the period of the Renaissance? Well, we have to get someone from there. The Age of Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, the Age of Exploration, the Age of Industrialization. Did these segments of Western history figure at all in your thinking, or what kind of a process did you use to find the individuals you selected?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. It's a great question. So I did quite simply keep it very direct to the definition of directly saved or improved millions of lives. So that is actually, I guess there's two things there. That's why the earliest hero is only from the 15th century, is because I found before then getting direct proof that single individual from 2,000 years ago did that specific thing to be very difficult. It could be likely, but I kind of wanted concrete fact that is indeed the case. So that's how we kind of, I did it from a historical perspective. And this also meant, because of our definition, there will be a lot of innovators that aren't actually included. Because the book can only be so long, and because I think it's impossible to rank the impact of everyone's work who has ever lived, there's a lot of innovations have happened in the world that are involving dozens, if not hundreds, if not millions of people somehow involved in air creation. And unfortunately, some just weren't included. And an example could be the aeroplane, the inventor of the aeroplane. I know the Wright brothers had some role, but there's actually a lot happened before then, and it's not a lot of people were involved. So I couldn't do a chapter with 20 different biographies in. It's kept it limited, and the automobile is the same. So I didn't really look across historical eras deliberately. It was just, and I think kind of Centers of Progress might have done so a bit more, the sister book to this. So no, I didn't do that deliberately. It's just stuck to the definition. But thank you for the question.
Yes, right in front, and then we'll come back to you.
Anytime I hear hero, the name of hero, it comes to my mind that the rest of the humanity or people, 7 billion, 8 billion people, are worthless. only few people are the one that get all the credit and completely disregarding the reason that somebody could come over there to become hero. Is like, for example, over going back, like Microsoft, everybody looks at the gate as a hero or creating it. That, well, that's not true. Maybe he doesn't know even 1 billion of it, but thousand of
I
thousand of thousand.
I wanted to ask a question. I'm sorry, but
no. I mean, that's my question. That while thousand of the people in any field are working or progressing or creating all those conditions, why should be given one credit to one person?
Okay, thank you.
Oh, thank you. So it's certainly not the case, just because I've listed 65 heroes of progress, that anyone who's not a hero is worthless or anything like that, as you indicated. When it's the case that an innovation has thousands of people who were very much involved in it, I have not listed that innovation. If it's the case that thousands of people were at some point in history involved, but one person managed to turn that idea and make it marketable or actually transformed it in a way, the steam engine could be an example. James Watt, sure, there were some steam engines that kind of existed before him, but he was the one who managed to transform it to basically turbocharge the Industrial Revolution. So no one's worthless because they're not a hero, but I can't write a book about the thousands of people involved in each innovation. So some discretion I had to have.
Okay, one in the back. Do you have a hand up? No? Okay, so sorry.
Hi, my name is Raj Lakiani from Athena Power. My question is for Clay. Mm-hmm. You know, when you talk about this notion of sort of desensitizing yourself via watching apocalyptic movies, et cetera, I guess I'm kind of struggling with that to an extent of, you know, you talk about the aspect of movies, but, you know, when we talk about other forms of content that maybe have desensitized us in maybe not a positive way. For example, you watch the news, you see shootings, killings, and we see it every day, every week, every month, you know, hurricanes. I mean, I feel desensitized. I work in energy. You know, I think where do we find the balance in that? Because maybe it makes us apathetic and oblivious to doing nothing when we should be doing something. Thank you.
That's a great question. So that's why I was hesitant to suggest that I'm not making the argument that there are no negative effects. And it's also hard to make any kind of argument when you're talking about watching like a 2-hour movie or something when there's a lot going on in there. I do think you make an important point about there is a distinction, I think, between what we would like to think of as news, which is telling us the stories of, you know, what's going on in the world. And I would agree, and I think there is some evidence to support that too much consumption of negative news media is bad for people. And we do need a balance of more positive news. But what I was talking about specifically, I think, is more of what we would call clearly defined entertainment, like fictional entertainment. And at least part of the argument there is it's not that it's desensitizing you totally to, like, the problem. I mean, you go into entertainment, you watch a fun movie to begin with because you want to be, you know, because you want to be entertained. But the argument there is that it goes well, actually, with the mental health point I made. So one of the arguments with mental health awareness that we're seeing, one of the big cultural movements is people should spend more time protecting their mental health. And what the prevalence inflation hypothesis is that, like, to do that, you need to avoid, like, if you're anxious, you should avoid things that are going to make you more anxious. You should kind of retreat in. And I'm not saying anyone else is making this link. I just think there's a link there that, like, well, if that's true, if it's bad to, like, we know that it is bad to avoid. In fact, like, one of the most effective ways of dealing with a phobia is exposure therapy, right? So it's to confront your fears. Well, I think that's kind of like a lot of the way this entertainment works. Like, you watch something that helps you, like, confront your fears instead of, like, retreat, instead of saying, hey, I'm not going to watch those movies because I can't handle any more content about climate change because it's triggering me. It's to say, no, I'm gonna consume this kind of stuff. And that actually does maybe help you be less emotionally responsive to it in a positive way. And again, I'm not saying there's no potential negative effects, just that the intuition or the assumption that having all that media out there is bad for people, I think it needs a closer examination, because it might actually have a number of psychological functions. But to be clear, I think that's distinct from the, like, news media landscape, which I would agree is extremely negative and pessimistic and often difficult to avoid. You know, it's hard to, you have to go to human progress to get more positive stories.
Yeah, I mean, you are in charge of the news that you consume, you know, and one way to balance it is to sign up for countless of optimistic newsletters, of which human progress is one, which I highly recommend. There's a last question from the gentleman here in front.
Thank you, Mark Lerner. I'm wondering if Marconi made it into your book. Marconi, the inventor of the wireless communication, long-distance communication, because the author, Eric Larson, describes him exactly the way you do, with these characteristics of just total focus on his invention and being disagreeable. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you have a hypothesis about why so many of these people have that personality trait.
Well, thank you very much. Unfortunately, he doesn't make it in. I tried my best to research as many people as I could, and he must have unfortunately slipped through the cracks. The book is certainly not all-encompassing. It's likely some other people out there in the world, maybe many, meet this narrow definition, but aren't in there, unfortunately. Well, and with disagreeableness, it could be, I think one of the things, and I think you've mentioned this in your writing before, Marin, is people who are more social are more likely to come up with a social solution to a problem. Whereas if you're kind of more focused, not on the social world around you, you're much more likely to come up with a technical solution, which then lends itself to a lot of technological innovation. And then it could simply be, in order to make a lot of these innovations, you had to do hundreds or thousands of experiments, maybe over decades, depending on the field. Or Richard Cobden, when he was doing his free trade campaign, he'd had to go across the country, spend huge amounts. It took many years. So there needs to be that, and disagreeable people won't take no for an answer. So they will keep on going regardless of what others say, or regardless maybe of what their bank account says or their family says and what have you. But I think that's a couple of reasons.
Yeah, so this is a paper by von Hippel, whose first name I forget, but basically his point is that human survival depends on human cooperation, sociability, such as, you know, hominids figuring out that throwing rocks at the approaching saber-toothed tiger or whatever was a great way to defend themselves. But human flourishing, not human survival, but human flourishing, depends on technological progress. And whereas society drives people toward conformity, technological progress depends on people who are nonconformist, who don't want to deal with other human beings, who want to figure out a way addressing whatever the goal they have via a technical mean. So a perfect example would be you're on a beach, you ask your wife or your husband to put a lotion on your back, but a disagreeable technological guy might say, I would rather create a contraption which will do it on my own, right? But the human flourishing actually depends very much on technological progress, and those are mostly people on the autistic, of the autistic type, populating Silicon Valley and places like that. So we'll end with a quick question for Alex. Who is your 66th hero of progress that you wish you had included?
The gentleman Miss Marconi mentioned.
Very good. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Please help me thank our speakers and join us upstairs for lunch. Thank you.
Thank you.